On July 17th, 1996, TWA Flight 800 exploded in the sky.
A missile or some kind of streaking object was seen in the sky at the same time TWA Flight 800 exploded.
I saw an object rise out of the ocean.
It was moving very rapidly.
And then start climbing, passing my altitude, and the explosion.
And the very next day, the FBI came to talk to me and said, "You did not see that. You saw nothing."
The TWA Flight 800 in-flight breakup was initiated by a fuel air explosion in the center wing tank.
We didn't find any part of the airplane that indicated a mechanical failure.
The explosive forces came from outside the airplane, not the center fuel tank.
The FBI did all the interviewing of eyewitnesses.
No witness was ever allowed to testify.
For that kind of cover-up to be tolerated, it makes me fighting mad.
TWA Flight 800, an Epic's original documentary.
Hi, welcome to the Whistleblower Newsroom. I'm Christina Borgeson, here with you today on the 24th anniversary of the explosion of TWA Flight 800 off the coast of Long Island that left 230 dead, after which strange things happened, including the military stepping in to give radio instructions to New York Police Department divers not to start recovering evidence until their divers from the Explosive Ordnance Division showed up to give them orders where to dive and where not to dive. Thus began what can be described as a massive multi-government agency effort to cover up the truth about what happened to TWA Flight 800, all in the guise of an in-depth investigation that resulted in a fraudulent conclusion. At this point, everyone knows it. However, every year, the cover-up is refreshed. Last year, by the press. Last year, the Smithsonian Channel did the honors, and we'll see who comes forward this year. That said, what's unprecedented about this story is the number of brave people who over the years have stepped up and told the truth about what they saw and know. Like the eyewitnesses who have been endlessly bashed by the press and former government investigators. But maybe the bravest of all are some former government investigators who worked on the crash and have come forward to blow the whistle on what really happened. Among those, and perhaps the bravest of them all, is my guest today, Henry F. Hughes, or Hank, as he is known to his friends. As a seasoned senior investigator for the National Transportation Safety Board at the time of the crash, Hank was assigned to respond to the crash and then to look into how and why people were injured or killed, and finally to reconstruct the entire interior of the plane. Practically from day one, Hank knew things were wrong, and they only got worse from there. So today on this edition of the Whistleblower Newsroom, this edition that I'm calling TWA Flight 800, Remembering and Reviewing, there is no other guest to have but Hank for this show. Welcome, Hank.
Thank you very much.
So I want to start off by having you talk to us about your experience and the things that come sharply to mind on this anniversary of the crash.
Well, I guess the best way to start is it was the most unusual investigation I'd ever participated in, and I investigated thousands of incidents, everything from rape, robbery, murder, and then all my years at the NTSB as an accident investigator, investigating shipwrecks, train accidents, pipeline explosions, major aviation and highway cases. It was the most extraordinary in terms of violating appropriate rules and procedures that I'd ever been assigned to participate in.
Now, you know, it's interesting because after the documentary that we worked on together aired, people kept coming up and saying, "Oh, well, you know, these guys, why didn't they say something while they were investigating?" And you actually did.
Yes, I did.
In May 1999, you went before a congressional committee, a Senate Judiciary Committee, called the Administrative Oversight of TWA Flight 800, that was chaired by Chuck Grassley. And boy, did you ever make a statement. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, well, I talked about the unprecedented interference by the FBI, the lack of leadership on the part of the NTSB senior management, and the irregularities that occurred during the investigation. I wasn't the only one. We had our chief metallurgist, Michael Marks, and material scientist Frank Zakar, who were also NTSB investigators, who sat with me at the table while our senior management stood in the back of the room and said nothing.
So let's talk about what you guys said, because the first thing you said just blew my mind when I first saw the video. It just blew my mind. What was the first complaint you had? Do you remember?
Well, it's been a while.
I'll just refresh your memory for a second. Yeah. You know, you were talking about the FBI recovery team and their level of experience and what you had to do.
Oh, yeah. Well, the FBI has a group called the evidence recovery team assigned to each FBI district. There were 28 of them assigned to the NTSB investigation, and they worked there for a period of 2 weeks each. And it became very apparent that these folks didn't know anything about basic forensics, about evidence identification, collection, or preservation. And so after a week or two of this, the FBI supervisor in charge asked me to put on a basic forensics class for the evidence recovery teams so that they'd understand what to do and what not to do. But there was a lot of mishandling of evidence because of, I think, lack of knowledge more than anything initially.
I mean, that's absolutely stunning that here you have this massive investigation. You guys at the National Transportation Safety Board, you have the expertise. You know how to do this. And right. Just because it's a suspected terrorist event, all of a sudden the NTSB, actually, they're not allowed to take over your investigation. They were only supposed to be conducting a parallel investigation or their own investigation. Is that not correct?
Yeah, well, in terms of jurisdiction, once an airplane crashes or there's a train accident or a shipwreck, pipeline explosion, the NTSB has primary jurisdiction because at that point, lacking any evidence of a crime, it falls within the responsibility of NTSB to conduct an accident investigation. Now, the forensics involved and the procedures and techniques aren't magic. It's basic forensics. But the point is, the FBI's role should have been secondary until such time as physical evidence, witness statements, or other information would have led to the establishment that a crime had been committed. There was no such evidence developed. So the FBI should have been in a supportive role of the NTSB. We needed to work together because the FBI does not have the technical expertise to conduct transportation accident investigations, but it's not a contrary or opposing activity. Those things should have been done concurrently. And when we initially arrived, there were maybe a handful of people in the hangar with me getting ready to do the reconstruction from the NTSB. And we're kind of outnumbered by, 50 or 60 FBI agents running around. They wouldn't allow us to do our jobs initially.
Now, let me ask you something. Why do you think I mean, now, you know, you're looking back 24 years later. Yeah. Why do you think that happened? Why do you think the FBI was given so much power when they didn't even have the expertise to run this thing?
I think it was basically a philosophical thing. They, you know, the FBI, whenever they go anywhere, they assume they're in charge of anything. And usually, you know, they were the gun toters, not us. But although that never bothered me, but the corporate attitude, I guess, if anything, was that we're the FBI, we can do anything we want. And the problem is, a lot of the things they were doing were wrong and contrary to accepted investigative procedure.
Well, I'm going to, just for a quick second here, I'm going to go down the list of 16 things that you mentioned. I don't, you know, and you know, cut in when you want to make a comment, because I mean, this is really shocking. You know, you said that they failed to establish a proper chain of custody on clothing and particulate matter taken from the medical examiner's staff.
Yes.
You said that they stowed blood-soaked passenger and crew clothing in refrigerators that that refrigerators broke down and all of a sudden mold cultures started growing on the clothing and other evidence.
Right. Let's stop there.
Okay.
With regard to the particulate matter and also foreign bodies that were embedded in the victims at the medical examiner's office, they commingle that material rather than separated by victim and documenting it photographically. That never happened. They just put it in a sterile plastic container, but it was commingled. The other issue that you brought up was the clothing and some of the personal effects, to include some remains of the victims, were stored in a refrigerator trailer that was on site at the reconstruction area. Unfortunately, they didn't realize that they had to refuel the reefer unit, the refrigeration unit for the trailer. So for 4 days, it was heated. And unfortunately, a lot of the potential information that we would have gained, or evidence that would have been present, was destroyed. In fact, senior investigator from the FBI and I, Susan Capozzi, wound up putting full biohazard gear on and going into that trailer to sort everything out, and were shocked to find what we found in the trailer in terms of human remains and the condition of the materials that were stored there.
So let's keep going. They took seat covers off without documenting where they came from. They didn't x-ray seats in an organized manner, and they missed several rows of seats.
Right. Well, that's
go ahead.
I think it'd be better if I commented after each
okay.
item. With regard to the seat covers, they were important from the standpoint of, were there any blood stains on the seats? Was there any object embedded in the seat backs? And when I established the reconstruction area in the main hangar, I had a reception area for the parts. And as they brought the parts in, they were all segregated. And anything with regard to the interior of the aircraft, specifically the seats, I had the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms bring in a portable x-ray unit. And before we started to examine them, each one of those seats was swabbed for explosive residue and x-rayed. That lasted for about a week, and then the FBI decided to discontinue it. I might also add that when we first arrived at the hangar, there were somewhere in the neighborhood of 20 to 25 ATF agents. Now, if you're not familiar with them, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives is the premier agency of the United States government in terms of explosives investigation. You might have heard of them from some of the church bombings and fires. They have far more expertise available than the FBI has. However, because of a turf war between the FBI and the ATF, primarily because of Ruby Ridge and what happened to Waco, Texas, the ATF agents were forbidden to participate. They sat at picnic tables inside the hangar for days until finally I needed some help, and I didn't care what the FBI thought anymore. I went over, talked to their supervisor, and a group of 10 of them began to assist me in my work in establishing.
But Hank, isn't that obstruction of an investigation? Isn't that considered malfeasance of some kind, where you're obstructing the investigation because you're not allowing another agency with the expertise to do the job that they need to do?
It could be construed as that. If nothing else, it's incompetence.
I hear this incompetence stuff all the time. Okay, yeah. All cases. Oh yeah, they were so incompetent. After a while, when you have incompetence building on incompetence on top of incompetence, especially in this case where from Jump Street, you know, you had to go and literally teach them the ABCs of evidence recovery. That alone should have created some kind of bureaucratic response or some kind of response as, okay, this is how it's going to work because the NTSB knows what it's doing and you guys don't, but you have to get involved because they think it might be a terrorist event or something. I mean, truly, something is very, very strange here to me, and always has been, of course.
Yeah. Well, I attributed it to poor management. Rarely did we have senior NTSB management on the scene. Now, when I say that, 5 members of the safety board are political appointees. They have usually very little, if any, expertise in accident investigation. For instance, our chairman had been a real estate lawyer, from what I understand. But they weren't there. The other problem was the investigator in charge, Mr. Al Dickinson, was inept. When we go to him, when the staff would go to him and voice our concerns about things that were going on, he did little, if anything, about it. In fact, in most cases, just, you know, basically his attitude was, oh, well, too bad, and don't make waves. Well, I like doing things the right way.
Yeah, but I'm suspicious of it all, of course. I'm suspicious that that was his job to do right there, you know, knowing that there were huge problems, knowing that the evidence was being mishandled. The other thing we should talk about this is, you know, here you have the FBI doesn't know what it's doing. You have to train them. And meanwhile, they're taking the key bits of evidence, the bits of evidence that did and may or may not have or did have explosives, traces of explosives on them. And they're putting them in a room by themselves. And nobody else has access to that. Is that correct?
Yes, it is. Not only that, whenever we would pull evidence or want to send it to the lab to be examined, a vast majority of it went to the FBI lab in Washington. And I specifically made note of it and asked them to make sure that I got a copy of the lab report. Well, to this day, I've never received one.
And, you know, in our documentary, of course, we had Bob Heckman, the FBI agent who was in charge of swabbing for explosives, picking stuff and for swabbing for explosives. And he told us, he said, well, there were a lot of hits for explosive traces, but he says, a lot of those were false positives. So we went and talked to the guy who made the machines that they were using, the Aegis machines they were using, and he said, absolutely not. He said, absolutely not. Those things are...
That was also confirmed by Dr. Fred Whitehurst, who's an eminent...
chemist and was head of the FBI lab, yes.
Yes, he was. And there's, you know, that from what I understand, they had 110 positives.
Well, the problem was, until they shut down the whole swabbing business, it was almost like, oh gosh, you know, everything's coming in and testing positive for explosives. Let's shut this down because it's not going in the direction we want it to go. That's the way it smelled like to me after talking to everybody. Does it smell like that to you?
That is what happened. They shut it down like a light switch, and then they had an FAA security explosive specialist who was on the team there, and they didn't treat the FAA explosives guys very well, all of whom were eminently qualified. Most of them were prior Navy explosive specialists or military. They had one of them get up at a press conference and say, well, the residue they found, they did find residue, explosive residue, but it was from a canine police training exercise. Well, I talked to the officer who conducted that exercise with his dog, the actual individual involved, something they never did, and it wasn't even the same airplane.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Okay, so let's keep going with this FBI business. Because to me, when you add everything up, somewhere along the line, there's a tipping point where you go from incompetence to, oh, you're running a cover-up. What about people breaking into the hangar, into your part of the hangar at night? Could you talk about that?
Yes. Several weeks into the investigation, after we had established the interior hangar, which was about, excuse me, was about 200 yards from the main hangar. We needed more room, so we had a separate hangar where we began to construct the inside of the airplane. We did the cockpit, the main cabin area, all of the galleys and the laboratories and the lower cargo bay. There were two keys to that hangar. One was in the possession of Kenneth Maxwell, senior FBI investigator, or agent, I should say, who was assigned to the hangar by the FBI, and I was the other person. However, one morning I walked into the hangar, and I used to make it a habit of every night before I shut down, I was the last person out, I'd walk around the entire reconstruction area to kind of get an idea of what we'd accomplished for the day and what we needed to work on. And in the morning when I opened that and went in, I could see there was some significant disruption, especially to a galley area and a fuse box. And I reported that to the FBI security chief, who was an FBI agent. And we went to Mr. Maxwell, and I said, hey, you know, come on over and look. And he went over, and he said, okay. And we'd established a decent rapport. A lot of the rank-and-file agents that worked in the hangar with us were good people that I had faith and respect for. Maxwell ordered surveillance on my hangar. And 3 days later, they caught, quote-unquote, FBI agents from a different office, Washington, had broken into the hangar. Now, I was never told who they were or what their intended purpose was, but it was absolutely confirmed. There was no question that they were unauthorized and that they had picked a lock and gone into the hangar.
So what did you think when you saw that? What went through your mind then?
It, along with a lot of other things, raised my suspicion. And it wasn't just the FBI. About 2 weeks into the investigation, our team was called back to Washington to give a briefing to our senior management. It was apparently a little difficult for them to come up to us, even though we were working 16 or 18 hours a day. And we had to prepare a briefing. Well, we received a relatively new employee, Dr. David Mayer, assigned to the investigation, and he was working with a Navy supervisor of salvage group and a company called Oceaneering that was mapping the recovery of the wreckage. If you'll recall, the wreckage site was along a path, if you can envision a football field, divided into three areas, red, yellow, and green. And then to scale, we had an intact diagram of a 747 in the air, and we drew lines to the location from which each item of evidence was taken off the ocean floor, about 126 feet underwater. And it's not on, you know, it doesn't take anything but common sense to figure that if you have an airplane that disintegrates in the air, not all the pieces are going to fall exactly where they fell off the airplane. You've got wind, you've got currents, you've got thermoclines in the water, and depending on the shape and the objects involved and the weight, to some extent, there's going to be some intermingling of those parts. You know, things that were in the red area that on the airplane, you know, might have landed in the yellow or the green.
The red area being the area recovery. Where things flew off first.
Well, yeah.
And that's important. The red area is the most important, really, because it tells you, it provides you with clues on what the initiating event might be, where the initiating event might have happened, et cetera.
Right. Yeah, right. And David was tasked with preparing this diagram for our briefing in Washington. Well, I looked at it. It just happened to be there. It was happenstance in the office where he was working. And I looked at it and I said, David, why is everything so concise in terms of red, yellow, and green debris? We know that things from the red area wound up in green and yellow, and conversely, the yellow and green wound up in red. And his answer to me was, I didn't want to confuse the board members and the staff back in Washington when we did the briefing. I said, don't do that. It's called exfoliation of evidence. You don't change things. We can explain why it happened, but you don't alter evidence, period. And, you know, he was a new guy. I didn't want to browbeat him. But as it turned out, he was involved in a lot of things that changed amazingly and has never been made to answer for it.
Yes, let's talk about those. Let's talk about his work with, of all people, the CIA, to put together a report, an eyewitness, assessment of a report on the eyewitnesses. And, of course, the CIA did an animation that was so laughable. I mean, if it weren't so, I mean, I want to say criminal, but, you know,
well,
this
it was,
lie.
It was, in my opinion, it was totally inappropriate. First of all, the NTSB has one of the finest labs of its type in the world, probably the finest. They do animations, professional animations, based on evidence and witness statements at a professional level, at a high level.
Yeah, but they didn't want that, Hank, and you know that. I mean, we have to cut to the chase here because the eyewitnesses, they had to handle those eyewitnesses. The DIA got involved with the eyewitness accounts. The FBI threatened eyewitnesses who said they saw something go up and hit the plane, and then the CIA got this group together and put together an animation that was wholly bogus. So could you talk about those things?
Yeah, everything you just said is absolutely true. And of course, you know, in retrospect, you see that. And that's why after I got back and I testified before the Senate Oversight Committee, I was immediately transferred to a job basically kind of paperclips. My career had ended, but you have to fall on your sword for the truth, so that's the way it goes. But what's really criminal is the NTSB was not even allowed to participate in the interview process. The witnesses,
you mean?
I'm sorry. The NTSB investigator who was assigned to the interview group or to chair the interview group was an absolutely highly qualified, experienced investigator. He wasn't even allowed to see the FBI's 302s, which is their summary of interviews. Now, let me explain something about what's a real problem. A professional investigator, when they're interviewing an important witness, usually does record the interview on tape. When you're finished, usually you have two copies typed up. You send both of them to the witness, have them mark up any copy, one copy, and make any changes or corrections that they think is appropriate. You let them keep another copy of it for their own records. And then it becomes part of the file. If there are any discrepancies, you may have to go back and do another recorded interview. The FBI doesn't do that. They send an agent out that didn't have any kind of standardized protocol for conducting the interview to begin with.
Didn't have also the technical expertise to ask the right questions.
No.
Okay.
They conduct the interview. And then they write notes, a summary of what it is they think you said. I don't want to know what it is I think you said. I want to know exactly what you said. But it's never ever documented the right way. You don't write a summary of what it is you think a witness said. You write their exact statement as to what they said. And for over a year, Norman Wiemeyer, the NTSB investigator I refer to, who I worked with for years and was very, very highly respected, a great people person and technically excellent, wasn't even allowed to read the interviews, let alone conduct interviews. Now, what's interesting is one person in particular, during the Vietnam War, Norman was a Navy search and rescue helicopter pilot, highly decorated. Well, one of the witnesses was a man named Fred Meyer, a prominent attorney in Long Island. Fred Meyer had been a shipmate of Norman's, and in fact, Fred Meyer was Major Fred Meyer, one of the witnesses to the explosion, who was also a very highly decorated Navy rescue helicopter pilot. They served together and had been friends for many years. Norman was given a direct order not to interview Mr. Meyer.
Well, why?
Good question. Excellent question. I still don't have an answer to. But Norman and Fred did get together clandestinely, and Norman got an interview. But all of that information, you're talking about over 500 people, very few of whom even knew each other, scattered over about a 20-mile area, in varying degrees of specificity, talked about the same event happening at the same place in the sky at the same time.
Yeah, and you know what's interesting?
Then,
go ahead.
Well,
go ahead.
And then at the NTSB public hearing in Baltimore, that kind of reminded you of Citizen Kane movie, the day before the public hearing started, I have a copy of a memorandum written by the assistant FBI director, Mr. Kallstrom, James Kallstrom, to Jim Hall, the chairman of the NTSB, directing him not to allow any witnesses to testify. That's absolutely unprecedented. I can tell you, I participated in dozens of public hearings on major aviation cases and others, and at no time were witnesses prohibited from testifying at a public hearing. Witness testimony is critical. You have, some witnesses are better than others, but you have to take them on a case-by-case basis. But none of the witnesses were allowed to testify, yet David Mayer, again, did a presentation about from a study, a psychological study he read about how unreliable witnesses are.
Right.
Well, if you don't know what they have to say, and you don't have some control questions, something that a good investigator knows about, you know, where you know the truth and you ask the question that only a person who'd been there can answer, you don't get a full picture of what happened.
Well, David Mayer, as you put it, you called David Mayer Mr. Fix-It. That's what you called him.
And, yes, I did.
And I think you're right. I mean, he was the guy who did what he had to do with the evidence or present whatever he had to present at a hearing to create the impression that, A, the eyewitnesses didn't see what they said they saw, and B, that the official narrative about the center wing fuel tank exploding because of a frayed wire spark that they couldn't find ever, they never found it, could be plausible. I mean, the whole thing still is so troubling.
There's a lot more to his involvement that I could talk about. Very disconcerting. One of them was the changing of evidence tags. And
why?
When the Navy divers who did a magnificent job, I think, recovered a piece of evidence, they put underwater, they had metal tags, but they would write the GPS coordinates of the location of the evidence. Those tags remained on the evidence when they brought them to the hangar, and when we did the reconstruction, they remained. So we knew exactly what piece came from what area in the recovery area. One day, David Mayer came in and started to change tags, and I said, "Don't do that." He said, "Well, now we're making some corrections." And I thought, "What?" He couldn't provide an adequate answer as to why they were doing it. So I said, "If you're going to put another tag on there, I'll let you do that, but do not take these tags off." Period. So fortunately, I had four big New York State troopers on my team. And we watched, we made sure he didn't take the tags off. Well, toward the end of the process, the investigative process as it was, there was they wanted me to sign off on the evidence recovery information, and I refused to do it. I said, "These tags are inappropriately changed with no answer, with no explanation. And, you know, they've got to be corrected." Well, the end result was the general counsel of the NTSB, Daniel Campbell, and his assistant, along with my entire team of 10 people, met at the hangar. We went back out and reviewed the tags, and it was determined that they shouldn't have been changed to begin with, that the additional tag should not have been placed on them, and that the position and the record be changed. But I came back to Washington. They acknowledged, "Okay, you were right, we were wrong." We came back to Washington, and about a month later, I discovered a memorandum, which I had not been provided with a copy of, that said that my group had agreed that we were in error, and that they were changed, but everything was all right, and I had agreed to the changes, which was absolutely not true.
I mean, okay, so let me just, because there's other evidence, too, that they refused, that they fudged and you know, refused to, you know, allow to be seen, for example, the radar evidence.
Correct? Yes.
Could you talk about that? That's very important. Again, this is hard evidence because it's, you know.
Within a day or two of the on-scene investigation, I realized that air traffic control information was critical. The gentleman that they sent from the NTSB to do the air traffic control investigation was not a qualified aircraft air traffic controller. And when we were called to that meeting in Washington during their discussion period, I brought that up and I said, we need the best air traffic control specialist we can find. And, you know, and the gentleman that was, you know, I didn't talk behind anybody's back. He was sitting there nodding his head, yes, I agree with you. And I had previously contacted our deputy director, John Clark, and said, you know, the best guy in the business just retired from NTSB. Do you think he'd be interested? He said, yeah, absolutely. I handed the chairman of the NTSB, Jim Hall, the man's name and phone number, and I said, call him. He's retired NTSB, and this is at a meeting with about 15 people. Everybody right. heard it, and everybody agreed, yep, this guy's great. He's the best in the business, and he wanted to help out of a sense of patriotism. He wasn't looking for money or anything like that. Jim Hall never called him, never even attempted to contact him. And all it would have taken was a courtesy call. About yep. three or four days later, I was in the hangar talking to Special Agent Maxwell, and Mr. Kallstrom walked in, and we were talking a bit. And I was basically just inventorying what we were doing.
Investigation, James Kallstrom.
Yes, and at any rate, I was a little frustrated at this point because I felt confident that Mr. Hall would have called this guy. And I'm not mentioning his name because he's asked not that I did not.
Okay.
To make a long story short, I handed a piece of paper with a guy's name and phone number on it, and I told him, I said, he's the best man in the business. He actually found a cargo door 1,700 feet underwater that the Navy got back for us on a previous investigation. I said, but I think he's more than willing to help. I said, but, you know, and I explained what had happened with Mr. Hall. 20 minutes later, he was hired as an FBI consultant. He developed the air traffic control information, the radar data. And I also said, in addition to the air traffic control data, we need to get the Coast Guard vessel traffic radar data just in case. Because they're still talking about a missile at that point.
Right.
They hired the man. He did an outstanding professional job, very thorough. The FBI wouldn't let the NTSB see any of the radar data that he developed. What's interesting is, in that data, at the time of the explosion, there's debris going out the right side of the airplane, which was doing about 430-some miles an hour thereabouts, in excess of Mach 4.
Yeah, if it's going out in excess of Mach 4, it could not be an exploding fuel tank that would create that level of pressure, of explosive pressure. I mean, absolutely. Mach 4, that's...
explosive. High energy.
What does that tell you? What does that tell you, Hank?
It's high energy. In addition to that, when you look at the medical and pathological information that our group developed of the victims with the assistance of Dr. Wetley and Colonel Shanahan, who I brought in from the Army, one-of-a-kind type qualifications for both of them, and you look at the damage to the interior of the airplane, It only could have been caused by a very high energy event. Now,
meaning
a high explosion, and it wasn't in the airplane; it was just outside the airplane.
So that's what does that sound like to you? I mean, do you agree with what the project came up with after looking at the evidence, the radar evidence, the pitting on the external, the pitting on the fuselage, And also, you talked about the pattern, the damage pattern inside the seats. You were in charge of reconstructing the inside of the airplane. Right. And what did you discover after doing that?
Well, based on the witness statements, the physical evidence of the airplane, and I'll talk about that in a second, and the radar data, along with the highly irregular things that occurred, especially with regard to the Navy, it suggests a high-energy event, an explosion, not a deflagration, not a low-grade explosion like a fuel tank. One point that's important, from the time of the Gloucester Meteor, the first jet-powered transport airplane, to this second, right now, there have been two airplanes that blew up as a result of a center fuel tank explosion. The first of which was a 747 owned by Philippine Airlines. And they know what caused that, a bomb placed under a passenger seat over the center fuel tank. The other was Flight 800. Now, even at the board meeting, the NTSB final board meeting, Robert Swain of the NTSB Systems Group got up and said, although we found no physical evidence to support that the center fuel tank exploded, we believe that's what happened, which is ridiculous. It was so significant a finding that the FAA never bothered to make any immediate changes. You would think they would, but when they have thousands of airplanes flying around with center fuel tanks, and the only advice from the FAA is, hey, make sure you turn off the fuel pump or the center fuel tank. Although we found the center fuel tank pump on Flight 800, and there was nothing wrong with it.
You know, it's interesting. I want to move on to what happened. I mean, our team, TWA, the Flight 800 Project Group, TWA Flight 800 Project Group, we got together with six whistleblowers, among you and Bob Young from TWA and some others, who finally, for the first time, actually had a chance to compare notes, because you couldn't during the official investigation, because things were on purpose or purposely compartmentalized. Right. So one thing I'm going to reveal for the first time here and right now is what happened after in 2015, after we had a meeting with Charles Whetley, former medical examiner for Suffolk County, and Michael Kaplan, the current medical examiner. Why? Because we wanted the medical examiner, the current medical examiner, to consider reclassifying the manner of death for TWA Flight 800 victims. Could you want to talk about that, Hank, and talk about the significance of that?
Yeah, we sat down and reviewed the information with Dr. Whetley, and I believe Dr. Shanahan, or Colonel Shanahan, was also
Yes, he was part of that.
And after a review with the current Suffolk County medical examiner, his intention was to reclassify the deaths of the victims on Flight 800 to homicide.
Yeah, and he wrote a very long letter, okay? Yeah. He wrote a very long letter talking about radar, debris field, and additional physical evidence consistently contradict the official explanation for the crash as presented in the NTSB's aircraft accident report. Number two, insufficient sharing of evidence with the medical examiner did not allow for a reasonable evidence-based determination of the manner of death. Now, this is the medical examiner, right? Eyewitness accounts and observations were either ignored or misrepresented by the official investigative agencies, the NTSB, FBI, CIA. Premature and potentially misleading conclusions were generated regarding the possibility that a missile played a role in initiating the explosion. And serious concerns remain regarding the manner in which the investigation of the TWA Flight 800 crash was concluded. And he was writing this letter to the Office of Special Counsel. And what happened?
Nothing.
What happened is his boss, okay, Stephen Ballone, the Suffolk County executive, killed it.
Yeah.
Put the kibosh on it because it was too hot to handle.
Yeah.
So at 2015, the cover-up was, of course, alive and well. And then last year, the cover-up continued with, of all places for this to happen, it's the Smithsonian Channel, you know, the historians, okay, came out with a document, with a documentary that was fiction almost from start to finish. Do you remember any of the details of that?
Yes, it was a fairy tale based on the NTSB's report. They didn't talk to the principal investigators. Some of the people they talked to and portrayed as having been involved from the NTSB weren't even involved in the investigation. One person in particular who's made comment about it never, to my knowledge, even stepped foot in Long Island to, he sure didn't get, break any sweat working on putting the airplane back together. But they towed the party line. And, you know, it might have been entertaining, but it sure wasn't factual.
Well, but it's worse than that because it,
yes,
again,
it
it's promoting, it's promoting a fraud, you know.
Correct.
We don't have much time left, unfortunately. I mean, there's so much to cover, but yes. I want to ask you something. Who, if you had to name names and say, okay, these are the key perpetrators of this cover-up, who would you name?
I'd say Jim Kallstrom and Jim Hall. They're the heads of the agencies that were involved in it. You know, as far as the FBI, it may go higher, it may go to the former director, Mr. Free, I don't know. But that's supposition on my part, but based on the behaviors of Kallstrom and Hall, very suspicious. You know, they didn't get to be senior executives without, you know, they're members of the senior executive service of the government. I think if you talk to most career civil service employees, you'll see that the civil service system was destroyed by those folks because they sell their loyalty.
What is the senior executive service exactly? What is that?
Well, they used to have a GS 16, 17, and 18. And then during the Carter administration, in an effort to make the government more efficient, the Carter administration decided they were going to create a senior executive service, so they no longer had GS 16, 17, and 18. They were basically agency heads and deputies. And they created this organization called Senior Executive Service. This developed into a cult. And the thought was they could take these senior executives and put them in any agency in government, and that they could perform well and manage the organization. You know, a lot of them are career people, and some of them are political appointees.
You know, I'm going to we don't have very much time, and I really want to say this. Jim Kallstrom, you know, his history on this is really bad, but I really believe that Jim Kallstrom was also a victim of the plata or plomo, you know, lead
yeah.
or silver. In other words, you cooperate with this or terrible things. I have to believe that, and I feel Mr. Kallstrom, who is very ill right now, and who happens to be, like my son, a Marine and a Catholic, I would like to implore and treat Mr. Kallstrom to, you know, before he severs the mortal coil, as he gets older and this thing goes on, that he make a record of what he knows to really be true.
I hope so too. I'm a brother Vietnam veteran with Kallstrom. And for that matter, Hall was there too. I think he worked in the construction. But Kallstrom always impressed me up to the end as a patriot. And it saddened me to say what I did, but I believe it.
Yeah, I mean, I think the pressure on him was unimaginable, just unimaginable. And this is so short, I just want to tell everybody, you know, this is Hank Hughes. Hank, you know, you're much beloved by the TWA community and by people around the world that you don't even know for doing what you did, because what you did was brave. What you continue to do is brave. And today, on the 24th anniversary of this crash, I say thank you on behalf of everybody. Thank you, Hank.
Thank you.